The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Suppose you're wondering why we called you all together here tonight. I think we're going to give ourselves 5 minutes to talk to you. Main reason for that is, if we simply say, oh, start to throw us your questions, sometimes it's a little hard to get the pump primed. You just run in here from somewhere else where you probably weren't thinking about the subject. Probably not. You might have been arguing about it on the car on the way over, but I doubt it. So probably it would be helpful if we at least started off. I know Jan gave us a list of questions, and maybe I would pick a couple. And maybe three that I could give some principles, and Kathy can chime in. Then in, say, 5 minutes, we can say, ask questions on the things that we just said, or take questions off the list, or give us whatever is on your mind or heart anyway. We can do it that way. So let me start. One of the basic questions on here was had to do with relationships, friendships in the church. Where's that? Number 8. Let's take a look at that real briefly. I think it is a problem, in a sense. Trying to have friendships, say you as a couple having friendships within the church, you have to recognize some limitations. If you find people inside your church, you're the pastor, you and your spouse are the pastoral couple. If you try to find some relationship in which you can be completely open and let down all of your hair and cry and weep and so forth, you may find it's difficult to have a relationship with anybody in the church like that. It may be that you need to build bridges to another pastoral couple nearby geographically, hopefully. And I'll give you a couple of reasons why. Now, I'm sure I can balance this backwards. I'm not the kind of person that says you shouldn't have any close friends in the church. I would never say that. We wouldn't say that. But one of the problems with finding a couple of people who are very, very close to you and who share your vision for the church and who love you and you love them and you get along great, it's very natural to simply treat them without any regard for the fact that they're your parishioners. And two problems you can run into. First of all, you'll turn them against the other people in the church who are against you or who are frustrating you. See, if you start to talk to people and say, well, I've been getting a lot of flack from this person and this person and this person in the church, and it's really been bothering me and so on, you get close to someone else in the church who's sort of an ally, it'll be very difficult for that person who's listening to you not to become very unhappy and grumpy and angry at the people in the church who are the recalcitrants, the people who don't change and so on. And there are, I would say I've seen dozens of pastors split churches that way. They find people who really listen to them and who are really on their wavelength, and they open up totally to them. And those people lose their objectivity. And those people become denizens, out to destroy the enemies of their beloved pastor. I've seen that happen many, many times. One other problem happens when you open up all the way and start to talk to them about other things that you're dealing with in the church, talking about the problems of the lives of other people that you are involved with in the church, is that you will find that they'll be sitting there saying, gee, how neat it is that he's opening up or she's opening up and telling us about these things. But then they'll start and say, I wonder if they're talking to other people in the church about me like this. I wonder if they're as open about, how do I know that they're not talking like this about the things that they see in my life? And so we have found that though you can have mighty, mighty, mighty close friendships in a church, very close, and you can have some people who are closer than others and so on, I think it's silly to say. I mean, look at Jesus, who had 12 disciples, but he had 3 good friends amongst the 12, and he had 1 best friend amongst the 3. And I don't see any problem with that. But I would have to say that you do have to recognize limitations. And then what happens is when you pick up and leave your church, you even have to be rather careful about then suddenly taking your best friends and treating them in the same way you would treat other best friends, because now they've got a predecessor. I mean, they've got somebody who is now your predecessor, and you have to be a very, no, successor. I'm the predecessor. He was a successor, right? Someone who's your successor, and it's just as easy for that sort, same sort of thing to happen again. They'll know you better than the successor, and they'll say, well, what do you think about him doing this and that and this and that? And so you find that there's limitations, but if this sounds awful, it's not so awful. You do have to probably find other kinds of relationships with peer folks who are outside of the church, maybe in ministry in some other place, and that's some suggestions along those lines. And I'll have Kathy say something, and then we ought to just open things up.
I was wondering why Tim was starting with this particular question, and I came to the conclusion
poor
that
his
subconscious mind was setting the stage for us to say, as sort of a heading over everything else that goes on tonight, is that you have to go into whatever ministry call you go to as best friends with your spouse, because every other friendship that you're going to have in your church or in your town is going to have some brick wall that you finally come up against where you realize that it's them, not us, that there are pressures on the pastor's family, that even though you may have friends in the church, friends in the town, that really want to share your burdens and minister to you and be your friend, that there are some things that you just can't share, and you'll be frustrated if you try, because even your closest friends say, when it comes time to voting on your husband's salary, I would always notice it then that people that I would consider a very dear friend, that when the discussion came up about whether Tim would get a raise or not, and these dear, dear, dear friends made half as much money as what Tim was making, I would start hearing things like, well, he works as much as Tim does, probably more. I mean, what does Tim do anyway? And then my hackles would get up. And you realize that there's a big gulf fixed between you, that there's this chasm between the people who are in the ministry position and the pressures that you face that you can't share with other people. You'd be guilty of a breach of confidence if you were to say, if I were to explain to this friend, well, let me tell you the pressures that he's faced just this week. It would involve revealing things about lots of people's lives that I had no right to do. So in the final analysis, this is a good place
to
start.
Somebody understands my subconscious, too.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's what I'm trying to say, is that you have to go into your ministry as best friends with your spouse, because in a real sense, you're alone. Even if you have a staff person that we were blessed with, Ted and Ann, Cindy knows all of our secrets. I can't use any names tonight because Cindy was in our church in Hopewell, Cindy Welch. A really nice friendship between the other staff person. There are things even there that you have to be prepared to just support each other in and share with each other. And if you're not the best friend of your spouse, and if you're not cultivating friendship, in addition to all the other relationships you have with your spouse as lover and co-parent and all these other things, if you really aren't your spouse's best friend, you're going to find yourself pretty lonely when it comes to the pastor, because there's nobody else to share the pressures with.
So summary, and then the rest of the time is up to you. No questions? We've got refreshments really quick. In summary, if it really, I would have to say that if there's anybody else that you think shares your vision for your ministry in the church, shares your vision, if there's anybody in the church, anybody, who you feel like understands your vision better than your wife, if there's anybody in the church that you can feel like you can let down your hair to better than your wife, then you'll be in some trouble, because you can't have anybody in the church who's a better friend than your wife. Now, that's probably a general principle for marriage in general, but in this case, we're trying to show that it's a pretty important principle for the ministry marriage in particular. So that's the bottom line, and at this point,
I hope somebody else brings up later on just
all sorts
what
of
sort of things go into making you a ministry couple, what differentiates that from any Christian couple facing any general ministry, but we're not going to tell you what we think until somebody asks.
Right, because we're not sure. We're not sure until you ask either. You might want to follow up on. You might just want to follow up on what we just asked, and then move on to some other subject. You want to move to some other subject? Up to you.
I'll walk over with you this morning.
what makes a ministry couple different from any other Christian couple who have their own ministries? Why did I tell you that?
I don't know why in the world you put that into your mind.
We have hashed this out so many times with different friends of ours who are in the pastorate, who are entering the pastorate, who are leaving the pastorate, because it gets right to the heart of whether the husband's call to a church involves the wife signing on as the assistant pastor or in some other capacity other than some other layperson in the church. I mean, what is there such a thing as a pastor's wife's role? What is it? How much is it determined by the congregation and so on? So all those things are sort of sub-issues, and we've discussed them endlessly with individual couples and friends of ours. And so it's not something that I know that we've arrived at the bottom line on. We had a, probably our closest friends in the ministry when he was being interviewed for his church, where he still is after 13 years, 10 years. They asked Louise what she thought her role would be in the church, and at that time she was very feisty and you know, prone to be fairly aggressive about wanting her own life as distinct from her husband's ministry. And she said, well, if my husband was a bank teller, I wouldn't go down and help him count the money, so you're not going to expect me to have any special role in this church as from distinct from any other person who's a member here. Well, she has grown with wisdom as with age. That's an illusion. There are biblical reasons, there are practical reasons, there are marital reasons that is just not going to work, as if you go into the pastorate with that idea that it's his job and that you will be a lay person in his church, but that you don't have any special heart for his ministry. There are going to be tensions in your marriage that will really put pressure on it. And we've seen, that's been, I'd say, probably the single most prevalent issue in breakups in marital families, would you say?
Yeah, I would, you know, it doesn't make sense. You say, if my husband was a lawyer, I wouldn't necessarily be, I'd be saying, great, have your career, and I'd be supportive of him, but I wouldn't be needing to know everything that happened during his day. I wouldn't need to be involved with it like that way. I wouldn't need to be involved in that way. And it makes sense, except it doesn't work that way. That when we have seen pastors' wives who've tried to stay out of their husband's ministry to that degree, they found that the husband feels let down, the church feels let down. You could chalk some of that up to chauvinistic ideas of you know, traditional churches, but I don't think that's true. I think that probably the ministry, the pastoral ministry, is more draining and all-consuming than any other kind of job. It's like being self-employed. It's like being an entrepreneur. You know how when you have that kind of job, the job sort of spreads out over into your whole life. And yet, as an entrepreneur, whatever you're doing, it doesn't have the same kind of, you don't feel like it's got the same kind of earth-shaking ramifications for people. You might, when you're in a business for yourself, you feel like it's got earth-shaking ramifications for you. You've got to get this business off the ground, and the wife might pitch in, and she might be your secretary for a couple of years when you're trying to get a business off the ground. You're both working hand in hand, and yet it even goes beyond that, because that's crucial for you. But when you're in the pastoral ministry, you've got all sorts of people's lives that are on your back, and it's just a burden that I don't think you can bear by yourself, with your wife saying, "I've got my career, and you've got your career." So I think it's a major difference. And again, I don't want to go on too long, because I, in a sense, to answer that question we'll be answering that question all night with all the other sub kinds of questions. And there's so many issues, rather than try to cover them all, I think I'll just stop at that point. Mike?
I think mine's sort of a follow up to this. It's number five. Mm-hmm. To what extent is the husband's call a call also to the wife? How do you, I guess, go through the decision-making process when you've got a couple that are very different in terms of what motivates them, in terms of what they're excited about, different ministry philosophies, things like that, and you come to a point where well, where you've come out of a ministry situation and you've had two different experiences.
Yes.
And in the future, you're going to be going back into a
you and your wife,
situation.
You and your spouse, right? Okay.
Yeah, and the husband wants to go back into a very similar situation, but the wife doesn't. You know, how do you go through that process of decision making, and does it come to a point where, you know, the wife just has to accept that call and live with it, or does the husband have to forsake that call?
I'm supposed to repeat this question, right? To what extent is the husband's call a call to the wife?
And how do you decide when you're facing a call? If you have different reactions to it.
Could I add one more quick thing?
Sure. I'm not going to repeat that either.
Well, Elizabeth Elliot, for instance, teaches that the wife marries her husband's call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe that, you know, you comment on that in your answer.
I think we lean toward that. I'm not sure. Oh, that's so stark to say that.
I'd be glad to affirm that if I could define it in this way. The husband and the wife marry each other, and the reason... The foundation reason that they should be attracted to each other and marrying each other is they share a common vision, whether they're going to be lay people or you know, ordained people or whatever, that the common vision of what they see God calling them to be is something that they can add to each other in. And then that's not going to that's going to mean that the wife marries the husband's call, but only because she married the husband and she married him because they have a similar vision of what's valuable and what's worth doing.
Yeah, it means if the wife says, I'm not all that excited about this job, I'm not that excited about this ministry, this church, but I'll certainly go along, you know, that's fine. That's probably not sufficient. That doesn't mean that the husband say, well, since you've got to submit to me, you've got to come along anyway. The husband ought to realize that you're in for tremendous trouble if she doesn't have sense of call. The reason that she's in for trouble, you may both think that somehow you can confine your job to, you know, a certain amount of hours and it's not going to spill out into her life or into the home life. That's just not true of the ministry. That's the whole point. It's biblical. An elder is supposed to be given the hospitality. That means your home is involved in the ministry. You can't keep it out. Therefore, if the wife doesn't have that same call, you can't just say, well, tough lady, you know, off we go. You're actually facing the very same thing on a much smaller scale that you face in the church. When you come into the church as a pastor, your job is to work and talk and pray and confront and encourage each other until you can come to some common vision for what the ministry should be, and that's what you got to do with your wife. And it's very dangerous if you don't have the same vision. Right now, for example, you better start talking about it until you can come to some consensus so you can come closer together, knock the rough edges off of each other, and so on. So I do think the calls go together. It's not as bad for the wife as it sounds, frankly. What I'm trying to say is if the wife doesn't have the call as well as the husband, I don't think the couple's got the call. And therefore, the husband has got to work with the wife on it. It's not like, well, the wife... So when he says the wife marries the minister's call, the way that lays there, it looks pretty bad. Another example, David Martin Lloyd Jones tells a story how he was preaching about a missionary sermon, I think. At least it was... The sermon was such that afterwards a person came to him and said, I heard the call of the mission field while you were preaching, and I've been thinking about the missions for many years, but it really came home to me, and I can see that the Lord led me, and I made up my mind, I determined in my heart I was going to go into the mission field. Right away, Lloyd Jones says, well, are you married? And he says, yes. He said, have you asked your wife about it? And he said, no. And he says, and Lloyd Jones says, I don't know what called you, but it wasn't the Holy Spirit, because the Holy Spirit wrote the Word of God, and the Word of God says, if the husband's ahead, when we think of the word ahead, we think immediately of authority, and that's part of it. But if the husband's ahead, that means the husband and the wife are a body, just like the church is a body. With different gifts, there's a merger, and nobody can be independent of each other. One of the things headship means is you're not independent, you see. You're attached. So he says, I don't know what you know, he says, maybe the Holy Spirit's calling you, but you can't know until you've talked to your wife. And I think that's a fair thing to say.
Now, it's easy for us to say all this because we went through seminary, both students at the same time, in the same classes, discussing the same papers, and so we were pretty much up to speed as far as the things we were learning, the ideas that were exciting to us. And I can see that there's a danger if the husband is the student and the wife is the homemaker, the money earner, while the husband's in seminary, that there's a danger that your worlds have diverged already just in order to get the husband through seminary. And it's going to take a real effort at communication for the wife to be imbibing the same, the theology, the philosophy of ministry, the exciting ideas, the challenges that the husband is getting. You know, you come home, you're full of what you've learned in class today, and your wife is right. Dead tired from having worked and shopped and cooked and taken care of children, and you want to share the summary of your latest brainstorm that you got while studying in the library. That can be touchy, yeah. But boy, you have to figure out some
right.
way to do it.
You do what Nina Yenshka did before she broke her hand.
I was just going to say that.
She read all of John's books.
Isn't that right, Nina?
You did a lot of, continuing education alongside of John when he was in seminary. I remember she shared that last year in a panel we had. But actually, it happened several times, because what will happen is when one of your children comes along, when the next child comes along, there's a tendency for the wife to, in a sense, drop out and get absorbed in other things and actually get out of step again with where the husband is. So it's not something that just happens in seminary. You have to be constantly keeping up to make sure that you vibrate to the same notes so that your call is the same. So I'm basically saying, Mike, yeah, I think you, that the husband's call, the call is to the husband and the wife. Otherwise, all that imagery of hospitality makes no sense. It's not imagery, it's a command. And all that imagery of the husband and wife being a body, being one. So.
If you're into each other's lives the way you should be, that's not going to be as hard. The wife has concerns for the family. If the husband is uninvolved in the needs of the family, then he will tend to slough those off and say, well, there's no reason why we shouldn't go to, say, Manhattan, or, you know, somewhere where our children will be eaten alive. I mean, that, sure, sacrifice them for the Lord's work. But if he is as intimately in love with his children as the
That's
wife
important.
Is, and there hasn't been a divergence,
right.
then he'll set the same priority on the needs
yeah,
of the family.
Yeah, you understand that. That's pretty
and
important.
And not be just moving away in his own
right.
direction while the wife is saying, hey, what about
Yeah,
us?
One of the reasons why a husband said, I'm getting a call to this church in this place, and the wife looks at it, and one of the reasons the wife might say, I don't hear that call, is because she says, it's just going to be more of the same. You're out of touch with my world, you're out of touch with the family, and you go there, it looks to me like a bigger place or greater ministry, and it looks like the gap's going to continue. And she won't trust, and rightly so, I think, she won't trust your discernment if she doesn't feel like you're in touch with her part of the world, too. Your worlds overlap. It's not that, you know, the minister's in the career and the wife is with the family. The ministries overlap, but there's no doubt there's still specialization. And you have to make sure that you're up on the other person's specialty. Very much like two doctors, you know, in the same practice, and one is majoring in one sort of practice, one is majoring in the other sort of practice, and you need to be reading one another's publications in order to make sure that you don't just get off on a branch far away from the other person and you've lost touch. Seminary faculty have to do that. Seminary faculty need to stay a body, so does the husband and the wife.
Change the subject.
Or stay on it. Yeah,
well, I have to go beyond, or to develop a bit further about sharing each other's ministry. How do you as the pastor decide how much you do share with your wife? Are you going to just spill it all, and every little jibe that you felt or comment that someone has made, or do you let that kind of filter and be somewhat discerning about what you tell them?
Nah. The question is, you probably heard that. You're pretty close to him right now. But the question is just how much do you share about your ministry with your wife?
We were on a panel with Jack and Rosemary Miller, and this question was posed, and it was interesting because we had two separate answers. Jack says, well, he didn't tell Rosemary very much because it got her too upset. And Tim said, well, we decided a long time ago that I felt left out, and so I would hear everything down to the color of the shoelaces. So I think it has to do with the style that you're going to the style that you're aiming at in your marriage has a lot to do with it, and the way you interact and the way you decide you want to handle that. If the wife is going to feel left out and alienated, then hopefully she's enough of a mature Christian that she would be able to handle any confidences and then therefore be entitled to them for the sake of you needing a confidant as much as any other reason. If the wife says, I don't want to know, you're just going to upset me, don't tell me, that's a valid response too, I think. I mean, that's what Rosemary and Jack were saying. And I just feel left out if I can't. And if you have enough wisdom, if the pastor has wisdom in how he presents it, rather than using his wife as the dumping ground for all of the undealt with sinful emotions, so that you don't edit anything you say to your wife, and you wanted to curse at your elders, and you didn't, so you came home and you told your wife just what you thought of so-and-so. I mean, before God, you have to edit anything that you're going to say, even to your most intimate confidant. You don't allow yourself to indulge in destructive, sinful emotions,
right,
and things. That doesn't mean to say, I felt like cursing him, but I mean, going home and exposing your wife so that she adopts your sinful attitude is going to be helpful to either of you.
Yes, she needs to know, and I need to tell her. And that's the reason why we talk about those things. I remember, though, that you do need to come to an agreement maybe early on in the ministry. You can have secrets, but you shouldn't have secrets. That is, for example, I should say to my wife, if necessary, well, listen, I'm not going to tell you what goes on in counseling. I think people, I just do not go into it all, and for various reasons, I don't want to do it. Then that's not a secret. Then my wife knows that that's a decision. Hopefully she agreed to it. In fact, occasionally I'd have people who would come to me and say, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell Kathy. Now that's something that often would happen, actually.
Because people knew that.
Because, in the ministry. And in that case, I'd say, all right. But then I would tell my wife.
No. He'd tell me.
Let's
get that straight. He would come home and I would say, well, what did so-and-so say? And say, well, I agreed not to say anything.
I agreed not to say anything to you. So it was a secret, secret. Yeah.
Yes, he would tell me.
If a person says, I'm going to tell you something, and as a pastor, my responsibility is let them unburden their soul and so on, says, I'll do it on this basis that you can't tell your wife. Somebody says, I'm going to tell you something, but you got to promise never to tell anybody at all. That's an old counseling ethic, and you basically can't say, sure. You have to say all these sorts of things. I'm not sure you should say, no way, or something like that, either. But if somebody says, I don't want you to tell your wife, almost always, that is not a stranger. Almost always, that's somebody who knows Kathy very well, might even be a friend, a girlfriend, and they talk a lot in the church or something like that. And I can understand it, and of course, I always will agree.
With one exception, if someone's coming and saying, I have a crush on you, if it's something dealing directly with
Kathy,
with our marriage or something like that, another person in the congregation is falling in love with Tim, then no matter what he said, he can come home.
Or the person, at that point, it was a rash vow. Just like Herod, the Salomean, the best thing Herod could have done would have been to break his vow.
Yeah.
I do believe you can break vows. Some vows are more sinful to keep than to break. But I do think that ordinarily what I would say to the person is, okay. If the person shares, I got a problem, there's a relational problem between me and Kathy, I would really press and say, well, you got to go talk to Kathy about it. Here's what it says in the Bible, and I'm not going to do it, but I will do it if you delay too long. And I'll keep pressing. And I've never had a problem, I don't think, with anything like that. But in general, our philosophy, David, is that we do share about that sort of thing, about the various sorts of things. Admittedly, I don't share everything just because you can't go over your whole day. And I might say, I never told you. The other day I talked to so-and-so and this came on up. But it's mighty difficult for me to think unless I can think out loud with somebody else, and my wife's the person to be. If you like that, your wife's the person to do that with.
can I use your question as a springboard for something that you may, nobody may ask, but I want to say. I have been coming more and more to the conclusion that your marriage is your own to invent under the principles of God, under the guidelines of Scripture.
Careful.
What are you saying? Careful.
Coming very close to my nose.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been constantly having to talk to people recently. It's been unusual for me to have to talk about the role of women and in marriage and in their marriages. And the longer I've thought about this and studied about it recently, the more it seems to me that there are scriptural guidelines that are givens, that you can't go beyond them or around them or anything else like that. The husband's the head, the wife, you know, is submissive. But defining that and instituting that is yours to invent in whatever way is agreeable to you. If the husband's headship says, "Dear, I'm going to study for a year, how would you like to have a career for a year and be the breadwinner and balance a checkbook and invest in the stock market or do whatever," that's not a good idea, or do whatever it is that would suit you best while I go off on and write a book for this year, why not? You know, if the husband would elect at that point and it would be agreeable to you both for him to do the shopping and the child care so he could stay at home and write his book or any other... or any other form that would suit your circumstances and your needs as people underneath the biblical guidelines and the headship of God, that I feel like God's given that freedom to Christian couples to invent their own marriage. Does that sound too radical? I'm not saying something that I think is terribly radical, but just it's been a freeing thing for me to think about, to see that we're not all straitjacketed into one, you know, that the husband has to know how to do all the home repairs and the wife has to be a terrific seamstress, you know. We have good friends where the husband actually sews his own clothes and, you know, the wife is an architect. Okay, if that suits them, you know, they're still obedient to God's word. They've kept their marriage vows. They know who is the head of the home, and the wife is laying her gifts at her husband's feet. So who's to say? I mean, I find that freeing. No, none of you wanted to know that, but I wanted to say it.
Ran out.
Boy, that put a dull cloud over it,
yeah,
didn't it?
I came with one question.
Mm-hmm.
In Korean church, a lot of the pastor's wife is very, in some sense, depressing. I mean, however, she has special, she has some kind of special talent. The ideal role of husband's wife as a pastor's wife, why should be just sit down and pray for the husband. And so if you do that and don't involve any other meeting, you know, it will be a kind of breakdown of women's meeting like that. It's not good for pastor in that sense. I want to know but I'm not going to work for the first generation for Korean people, but second generation. I want to know what kind of role of woman is ideal in this society.
To some degree, you're talking about a model of wife being a ministry support, and we're saying that as much as possible, it'd be great for your wife to be more of a ministry partner. There's a difference. It's with wives, for example, who have got gifts of public speaking and counseling and discipling, it's very easy to see those kinds of women almost stand alongside their husbands. They write books together, they do conferences together, and they are a very interesting model of a ministry partnership where the husband and the wife are together. When the husband does a conference, the wife goes off and takes the women sometimes for a sub-meeting and leads them, and they both counsel people together. And when you see those kinds of couples, it's good and bad. It's good in that it shows you that as much as possible, I think a wife does need to be a partner with the husband in ministry. The problem is that because she's got upfront public speaking verbal gifts, which are the kinds of gifts that in the Presbyterian Church we all value the most anyway, not the deed gifts. And when a woman has the word gifts, it's so obvious to see that she's a partner. And a woman, if you don't have those kinds of gifts, you might despair. You say, well, all I can do is sit and pray. But, you know, I know of other wives who, even though they do not have the verbal upfront gifts, they use gifts of administration, of helps, of mercy, of hospitality, of deeds, and they are extremely involved. For example, when the husband, if you're having a meeting in your home, you know, the wife can be just as involved in making that a successful meeting as the husband. She's not completely passive. She can be an executive secretary. Many wives are like executive secretaries for their husband. Husband can give the wife things to do, and she can organize, she can call, she can put the whole thing together. She actually exercises leadership gifts, even though she's not going to, when the meeting gets together, she may not be up there talking and so on. What I'm trying to say, Hong, is I think it's better to look at the role of the wife as a ministry partner instead of just a ministry support. And it's possible to be a ministry partner even if you don't have the kinds of gifts that some women have used to get into the spotlight more. Some women, you look at those and say, we can't be partners, I can just sit back and pray. And I don't think that's necessarily true no matter what your gifts are. Good question. Well, I just thought of something. One other thing, David. One of the problems with sharing everything with your wife is that your wife is almost always more zealous for your honor than you are. And that's right, and that's good. For example, many times she's going to help you at places where you're willing to say, let it ride. She says, maybe I ought to stick up for that. Or places where you are letting people walk on you, and she may say, I think at that point you need to say no. I would never say no if I wasn't married, all right? But if your wife falls behind you spiritually, which can happen, you ebb and flow, you know, husband falls behind the wife spiritually, wife behind the husband, you're married for 40 years, it's bound to happen. If your wife is falling behind, you may find that next thing you know, she's actually starting to resent the people you talk to her about that have been giving you a hard time, really get angry. And the wrong response, which I've seen often, is for the pastor to say, well, I better just not say anything anymore. The right response is sit down and say, hey, are you getting to the place where I'm afraid to tell you these things because I think you are actually, you're becoming bitter. You can't forgive, you can't treat the person in a gracious way. And the reason for that has got to be because either there's something wrong in your life. You yourself, you're not growing. You yourself are feeling stunted in some way, frustrated in some way. I don't know what it is, but instead of just not talking to her, you need to realize it's a danger signal. Sit down and decide what's going on here. But it's one of the problems sometimes of sharing everything. But I don't think it's the answer is just to stop doing it. So, yeah.
What can be done about? I'm thinking about most of the pastor's children I know are about the most devilish kids I've ever met.
When did you meet our children?
We have babysitters here that'll tell you the truth.
Why does that happen, and what can we do on our part to keep that from happening?
What do we do about the PK? That's the question.
You know, we were going to give ours to pagans to raise
right.
till they were 15
right.
and then send them to a young life camp so that they could get converted. We thought about it. We were thinking
of giving them to nudist socialists who could raise them and they'd probably turn out better. Now,
I don't know. You know, who has really studied the children of preachers and missionaries to see whether they've got more behavior problems than others? Has anybody done it? Surely somebody's done it. I mean, is anybody sure it looks like that preachers' children are ill-behaved, more ill-behaved than most. But
I wonder whether it's true or not, but let's assume that it is, for argument's sake. I think sometimes preachers get a bad rap around the church because they're so doggone familiar. You know what happens if your child walks into a Sunday school class, right? And that kid doesn't know anybody, but there's one other kid in the class that they know very, 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 very well. What happens? Because they're completely familiar with the other kid, they start to monkey around, they ignore the teacher and everything else, and there's no fear and trembling in them, you see. They feel like, I own this place. The trouble with preacher's kids is they're more familiar with everybody than anybody else is, any other kids are. There's no awe. And that might be one of the reasons why they're so ill-behaved around the church. But having made all my excuses, maybe you want to start on what do you think are the reasons? Well, there's one problem
that I think that pastors' children are prone to, but it doesn't necessarily need to be the pastor. Anyone who's got a high visibility Christian life, talking elders, missionaries, youth workers, whatever, is that if there's any inconsistency in what you say publicly and profess in your ministry and the attitude that goes on in your home when you're off duty, your child will become cynical so fast it will make your head spin. They will pick up immediately. I mean, if you could pick up Hebrew like this, you could pass your final the first week. They will pick up so fast that all of the highfalutin values and the great truths that you're espousing are so much... what did you say?
Rhetoric.
Yes, they're rhetoric. Thank you very much. They're the currency of your job. You have to say that. But when you come home and the lights are off and the shades are down, then what you really think about your life with the Lord is just a very mechanical, job-oriented thing. I think that that has to account for a large proportion of what's the matter with pastors' kids is they become cynical very, very fast. That's not all there is to it, because I've seen families in which that has obviously not been the problem, that the parents are transparent. Whatever they are publicly, they're also privately, and that there's not any inconsistency for the children to focus on. And then there are other problems that they can fall prone to.
Yeah, well, secondly, the fact is that PK kids
don't see their
father as much as they ought to.
Yeah.
And just about any kids that don't see their father enough are going to have some problems, I would say.
Don't you think also that people have a higher expectation of how pastors' kids are going to behave? I mean, I do. If I see...
Cindy, you ought to know better by now.
I know, but you know, you do. You can't help it. I caught myself doing it in Sunday school one week with your kids.
No.
I thought, David...
Come on, kids.
You know, and I want to go
you know who you
them.
Are.
You should behave.
Right.
But I mean, and other kids were in it too, and so I caught myself and said, no, they got it. But...
That can make kids cynical too, actually. Yeah. Well, in other words, if you cut them a break, you realize that people can have higher expectations, and also they, you're actually giving some mitigating circumstances.
I thought of a big one, though. When we were at our former church, West Hopewell, we didn't find out until the week that we left town that our son Michael had to be expelled from his Sunday school class every week.
It was Children's Church.
Yeah, Children's Church, for weeks on end, and no one had told us that he had been so disruptive that he had to be sent down to sit with the elders, the deacons, whatever they call it.
Every week.
He had to be kicked out of Children's Church.
That went on for about a year.
Well, yeah, for about a year.
The kid was only four. He couldn't have, when we left, he could have gone on for years.
Right. Well, anyway. And when we tried to analyze why we didn't know anything about this, a couple of things came into play. One, people were afraid to say anything. Okay, two, people knew Michael. Ted and Ann knew Michael really well, and they liked him, and so they didn't feel like it was a burden to have him sitting down there chattering away. One-on-one, he's a delightful child, but he was just real disruptive in the class. And they, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal to them. They didn't see it as part of the overall parenting that we should be following up on this and doing whatever. So the fact that people that your child thinks of themselves as a celebrity in the church and can get away with other things and not get the same kind of negative feedback that, say, another child would get. Michael was convinced, you know, that he could do no wrong in anyone's eyes, and he still suffers from that.
Yeah, I mean, just one other thing. Don't forget what you're going to say, Craig. I think, in a sense, what you're saying, what about solution? There's no doubt that, in general, if you want to go into the ministry, though you shouldn't be judged with a higher standard than other believers. The fact is that you are in a fishbowl, but worse yet, it's the fish in the fishbowl, your little fish, your guppies, are watching you even more than the people outside the fishbowl. And you just can't get away with it. You cannot. Here, let me put it this way. Becoming a minister will make you, some of you heard me say this, much better or much worse Christian you would have been otherwise. Because in the past, you really could let yourself slide for a couple of weeks. You didn't have to necessarily always feel close to God. The point is, you see, when you're a minister, you're always getting up telling people, every day you're telling people how great God is and what they ought to be doing. And you can either put on the ministerial front and just do it even though your heart's cold, or you can wrestle back into the presence of God like every couple of hours. See, which is the only alternative to becoming a hypocrite. It's a similar kind of pressure. It's a good pressure. I don't know what you say. Is that crushing? We should feel that way anyway. Every Christian ought to feel that way. We don't. The ministry sort of forces you to see it. The same way with your family life. You just cannot. You cannot be yelling. You cannot be. If your family sees you on the phone saying, "Well, hello, Mrs. Jones," and then hanging up and turning around.
And witch, what's she calling me?
And everybody else. You've been doing, you know, most parents do that. But you won't be able to get away with it without creating cynicism. Sorry. Well, you shouldn't be doing it anyway. You should have integrity. A Christian should have integrity, which means he's an integer. He's a whole person. He's not fragmented or fractured. The only other thing you have to do is you better take a look at your time. And instead of thinking in terms of hours, take a look at your life in terms of 7 days of three segments each. Every day is divided into thirds. And each one is a segment. It has three segments, a morning, afternoon, and evening. There's 21 segments. Make sure that your family gets seven of them. Fight and scratch and scream to get seven of those 21 to your family. Or to you. I mean, the fact is that you want some of it for yourself, of course, and you need that. What does that mean? It means one whole day off, and it means an afternoon somewhere and three evenings. That doesn't seem like much, but for most ministers, that's a lot. If you find yourself getting out...
Nina, when we were in Hopewell, he had five or three.
No. When I was in Hopewell, I had three of the seven, three of the 21. That was it. I was when we first got to Hopewell, we had no children. I had Monday off, and I was out every other bit of the time. Every other segment was gone. When I had one, when the first kid, in fact, actually was two, because remember, for a long time,
we used
to teach a course on my day off. That was nice. But anyhow, when the kids came along, every time I added a segment, not because I wanted to, but because I was virtually forced to, or my family would have fallen apart. And so I eventually got up to about five, maybe five at the most. So I did, obviously, since I had three kids, I didn't add a segment for every kid.
We left
town to get to our seven. But I would say fight and scratch and claw, because I think you need those seven. And that is... Yeah, but you...
Can I say something to that?
Why should I speak to that? I wasn't the
This one. Is something that I think comes up in an awful lot of Christian women's minds, and especially the pastor's wife, is, okay, you're submissive, but what if your husband is really mishandling something significantly, whether it's not taking enough time off or not realizing... Submissiveness does not mean being a doormat or being so meek that you are a total useless body to your husband. I mean, submissiveness means you're offering all that you are to be his helper. And if that means your wisdom to a blind spot that he has, then you had better offer it as forcefully as you're able to. Not in an ugly way, not in a way that's creating fights and whatnot, but in a way that God put me here as your helper, and here's some. Am I hitting you? God put me there as your helper, and here's something you need help with.
Well, I don't think you should go so far as to say that you should never cause a fight.
Oh, okay.
Now,
this is good.
Yeah. Let me
you're hard to fight with, though.
Sometimes
you're hard to fight with.
I want to say sometimes she did this right and sometimes she didn't. But let me tell you, when she did it right, here's how it goes. You got to remember, the Bible says that friends, as iron sharpens iron, friend sharpens friend. Now, why, if your marriage is the ultimate friendship, should that whole thing go out the window? Some people say, obviously, a wife shouldn't ever come after, admonish, rebuke her husband. I don't.
Well,
I've
heard Christian women say that you should let him drive the wrong way down the street and miss the house he's going to rather than.
But here's what it's
him.
Like.
That's crazy.
Let me explain. Let me explain the right way to do this on a different level. I've got on my session. I used to tell them from the beginning. I used to say, listen, I don't care if you fight tooth and nail with me to express that you don't like my idea. And after we've fought it through and discussed it through and we take a vote. Now, I don't care what names you call me up until we take that vote. Once the vote is taken, there's two ways to vote no. The one way to vote no is to say no, but since I've lost, I'm going to support what you've done. The other way is to say no, and since I voted no, I have a right to go all around the church and undermine this whole program. I have the right to get on the phone, tell everybody, don't go to that thing. It's a bad idea. The pastor's all full of himself. It's a poor use of our funds and so forth. And I constantly said to elders, you're sinning if you vote no the second way. And I said to them, I said, if you ever see me doing the same thing to you, if I lose out, and then I feel like I can undermine it. So, now, if my wife was doing it right, this is what she would do. She would come at me sort of tooth and nail, not be afraid to even cause a fight. Then afterwards, if she lost the vote, she was still very supportive. She didn't decide, okay, I'm withdrawing, I'm going to be cold, because you won't listen to me, because you're out more than I want, I have a right to withdraw and be cold. That's the thing I just told my elders not to do, and it's not right. On the other hand, I don't think it means that she needs, therefore, to just sort of hint, you know, dear, you know.
We decided early on that leaking was something that I was prone to. That was not wanting to really confront the issue. I'm really angry at you because I never see you. But just leaking all these little whiny hints that just made him deaf and made me get angrier and angrier and angrier, that it was much better to cause a confrontation where I waved all the red flags and stamped my feet if I had to. I mean, now we've gotten more mature, I think, in our marriage. It used to be that I'd have to throw a tantrum in order to get you to take me seriously sometimes, right? But I think we've overcome that. That happens a lot in the early stages of your marriage, is you have to go to these excessive emotional displays in order to convince your husband there's really something to matter. Anybody recognize that? But you grow past that to where you really can read each other well.
Right, stop by the time you've been married 10 years, or you need to go see a counselor.
Anyway.
Wait, one other thing about the segments, being very realistic. I remember I had long debates with Skip and Charlie up in Charlottesville because they insisted that all the staff people needed to be out no more than three nights a week. Wasn't that it? That was it. And I couldn't believe that. I just said, you mean, and I think if I remember correctly, they said including Sunday. I could be wrong on that one. That seemed, I used to say, well, it's true. I used to say you have a different model up there. We have a smaller church. The people's expectation is that they want to see me. And there's no doubt about that. There's a big difference. Those guys were ranchers and I was a shepherd. And it's a big difference in the way, that's right. Absolutely. The difference, very big difference. Nevertheless, I realized, and you were one of the cows, weren't you? But I realized once you just don't have very much objectivity. It's good to not, it's good not to have only been a pastor of one church. Because it's not until you get picked up and lifted out of the situation when you realize that ultimately trying to see everybody and solve all the problems is like trying to dig a hole in the sand. It's always falling back in on you. And you don't make that much more headway. Meanwhile, you lose your family. One of the things I realized that if I needed, at a place like Charlottesville, where you had ranchers instead of shepherds, you could get away with not being out every night. You couldn't get away with that in Hopewell, but if I was going to be out more than three nights a week, why not make sure that, then I gave people afternoons? Why not say, I come home at 3:30, my kids come home from school, and I'm home from 3:30 to 7:30. That's 4 hours. That's an evening. Then I go out. You know, that's great, because the mother has to put the kids to bed, and she can't complain. It's great. So you stay home in the evening, you have to put the kids to bed. So there's all sorts of ways of skinning those seven segments, if you can get them. But I suggest that in the long run, if you don't, you'll have three heart bypasses by the time you're 50. So
Craig had a thought he was holding.
That's right, poor Craig.
PKs again.
Well, I have something I want to say about them, too. That's why I remember it.
How did you know he
won? Another thing I've run into in youth ministry from time to time are not the wild, rowdy PKs, although that has been the majority, but some of the most arrogantly self-righteous PKs, kids who are just ultra-holy and, you know, really
right.
can't believe.
We don't know anything about them.
Might smoke a pipe could be saved. You know, I've run into people like that in PKs, and I wanted to know how you balance that problem. And of course, I've also run into a few that are both. They're very self-righteous.
How would we know?
No, but that's, you're asking. I have a set of six good friends from seminary. All of us women married friends, and we've stayed together, and we write on issues to each other. And one of the ones that we've been writing on and talking about recently has been, how much control do you exert on your children? These are all now people who are pastors' wives, their husbands are in the pastorate. And I'm beginning to have a theory that the reason you see either cynical kids on the one hand or these ultra-holy, out of touch with the culture kids on the other is that the parents have exerted too many demands, too many controls on them, that they have to look the neatest and the most well turned out and brushed and not be messy and loud and wild, and that there have been so many extra demands made on them for their behavior and their appearance and their conversation and their attitudes and on and on and on and on and on, that it either reaches the breaking point where you get a rebellious child, like the Bible says, don't stir up your child to whatever it is, wrath or depression or however J.M. says it, that you've either over-controlled your child to the point where they've rebelled, or else they conform and they become a little goody-two-shoes, which only leads to a worse rebellion later on, or else it makes them a real, you know, nerd by the time they go through high school with their...
Or
a Pharisee, something like that. Raising a disenculturated child as a Christian family, whether you're a pastor's family or not, I think is a tremendous challenge, because you have to teach a child at an early age to focus on what is really the heart of the issue. My sister and I have been going round and round, if I can tell a personal anecdote here quickly, because we're letting our kids spike up their hair and wear their tails in the back. Well, my sister doesn't even want to see them. She and her husband think that's just dreadful. Don't even let them come visit us until we cut their hair. Okay? I mean, that's, she's entitled to her opinion. So, but then my boys are confused on the other hand, because their friends are allowed to watch Rambo movies and Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, and he went to a sleepover Friday night and they watched Howard the Duck. And we get all upset about that and say, you know, we have more demands on what you take on internally. Mm-hmm. We've tried to explain to them that they're free to be as with it as they can with their friends as much as they want to, as long as it doesn't transgress something that God has made it clear in His Word that we're to be different from the world. That there's no point in making a child be different from the world just in order to conform to your own personal taste. I don't like spiked hair. I think they look stupid.
Yeah.
But if my child can be at that point excused from bearing the responsibility to look different from his friends in something that is a non-moral issue, because I'm going to require him to look weird in a lot of other ways where it's a crucial issue. I don't want him swearing, and I don't want him snickering over issues of Playboy on the playground, you know, and so on. That a parent has to be able to tell the where to have the fights, in
right.
other words, rather than to make a fight over everything.
Mike.
I have a question on both in practice and theory. Is your ministry really more important than your family? Because describing your ministry in practice, it looked more important if time spent is the indicator, and I know that's dangerous. Now, let me give an example. In that readiness for ministry test you administer to us our first year. There's a question on there, something like, you already go on vacation with your family, you've been very busy at work, there's a special family event, and all of a sudden you get a phone call, you're needed for a meeting or you're needed for something. Do you go to the meeting or do you go with your family on vacation? Now that really seems to be the question that tugs at what is really your strongest value, your family, your ministry. I know it's hard to generalize, but could you address that kind of situation?
Well, if the case study said that you've been, I mean, there's a balance there. The answer is it depends on whether or not your family's been getting short shrift or... In general, in a case, I think the right answer to that particular question, the way, if I remember the way it was phrased, is that you go with the family and say, I'm sorry, I know I'm not indispensable. As Francis Schaeffer says in Joshua and the Flow of Biblical History, no man's indispensable, yet every man's unique. That's a hard thing to hold on to. Everyone's unique, that means there's things that you and you alone can do, and yet you're not indispensable either. Somebody can come along and replace you, not actually perfectly replace you, obviously, but you can be replaced. And you have to somehow keep that in balance.
That's
the answer is to say, go with your family.
That's when it's really important for the husband and the wife to share the same values in terms of the ministry, so that the husband isn't making decisions that this is more important than the family, and the wife would have made a different decision. I mean, that's going to happen sometimes anyway. But if it's always happening, if the wife is always deciding that, you could have told that person, no, there's no reason. You really need to have the same vision.
But even my taking care of the family, I'm taking care of the family partly because I realize that if I do, I am going to be a much better ambassador for the kingdom. And so it just isn't, it's not really that much of a trade-off. You experience the tension if you're a man-pleaser, which I am. You experience the tension because you don't want your wife to be unhappy with you, and you want your congregation or this particular person who you want to see to also think well of you. And you experience psychologically this tension. Actually, there's absolutely no conflict at all. If you could just get up high enough above the terrain to see the whole terrain, there's no conflict at all. It's not a matter of your ministry or your family at all.
One other thing. If your congregation is convinced that you love them and your family is convinced that you love them, they won't run the risk of turning a single occasion into a symbolic act that is going to mean more than what it actually means. If your wife knows you love them and you have to delay the day out of town that you were going to go Christmas shopping or the night overnight,
she'll give it to you.
Then it's hard. It's easy to let it go. It doesn't become this great symbol of how you always neglect us. The congregation knows that you're always there for them and that you really love them and you really just can't do it this time, they're not going to turn it into this tremendous symbol of how neglected they are either. Once a dear old fellow in our congregation died on Christmas Eve just as we were leaving that next morning to go up to my parents' house with the kids for Christmas, and they said, oh, go ahead, we'll get somebody else to bury him. I mean, heavens, he won't know the difference, and we know you love us. They really did. Remember Alice Mosher said that.
I spent a lot of time with the family, and because I'd been very faithful at being a pastor to them at that point. Now, let's face it, she wasn't all the pieces in the same
way.
She's a stroke invalid
for years.
Let's face it, she was a pretty mature Christian, and she was able to say, I know how much this sort of time means to you. I know how I'd feel. Now, a lot of women wouldn't say that. But the fact is that she had a couple other pastor friends. She'd been, you know, in the town all of her life. This fellow said he would be happy to do the funeral, and so I left. It's also true if you're keeping your family happy, they'll be constantly giving you things instead of saying, why aren't you giving me more time? They'll be like, many times Kathy will say, I know you'd really love to go over there and you'd love to do that meeting, love to do that, and it's okay, go ahead, I'd like to give that to you. And when that, you know, in a certain sense, when you're keeping it a balance there, there's not as much you don't experience as much tension because you find people actually starting to give you gifts instead of saying, where have you been? Tom?
Tim, you've touched on this partially, but could you develop along the theme of how you communicate your priorities to your congregation? It seems to me that in general, congregations are pretty demanding, and they probably haven't thought through the fact that the pastor has a family. How do you sort of lay down, establish limits? Do you say to your session, this time is mine, don't interrupt me? Or how would you approach that?
It depends a little. In a way, you're looking at even a bigger issue, and that is, how do you change people? See, if your congregation is older, they're not going to be as understanding. Or at least the older people in your congregation will not be as understanding. The people who are your age, with kids your age, will be far more understanding. And so it depends a great deal on the makeup of the congregation. In general, and it creates even more of a problem than that. In general, what happens is, you will tend to draw, you will attract people, the longer you're at the church, you'll attract people who are your age or younger. You'll try to attract everybody, you'll try to go after everybody, you'll attract the people who are your age and younger, as a general rule, at least the majority of the people. And then what you'll find is those people will be extremely concerned about your family life. The people who are older are people who have been there a lot longer the new people who come in are committed to you more than they are to the church. And they want your family life to be right. And the people who are older than you are more committed to the church and each other than they are to you. They've seen pastors come and go. And they either have forgotten, or they're not quite as aware, or they're living in a different age or something. And they will not be nearly as understanding about the minister getting family time. And it does create a lot of problems. It'd be very easy for you to look at your allies as the people that you let down your hair to and that you create without, in a fairly sincere way, a tremendous division in the church. What you need to do with the older folks, they're the ones who are going to be the biggest problem in general, is that you have to spend a lot of time intentionally building bridges to them, spending a great deal of time with them, even when they're not sick. Don't just stop in when they call for you, but you stop in and you work very hard at building relationships. As a matter of fact, do all of your visiting with the people that you just assume not visit. Don't visit the people you enjoy visiting. You're going to probably see them anyway. I mean, you're going to have plenty, it won't be hard at all. The people you really like being with, they're going to find you, you're going to find them, there'll be all kinds of, there'll be no trouble building relationships there. Visit the people you don't like, or at least you don't have any natural affinity for, and then, after you've done that, at the same time, try to communicate the need for you to also be with your family, and they won't resent it. But if you tend to stick with the people that like you and that have your vision for the church and that give you a lot of strokes, you're going to find that they're going to care about the family life, not the rest. Next thing you know, the people who you haven't been communicating with are going to make demands on you, and then it's almost too late to start communicating your priorities after it's already been nosed. People around are starting to say, this minister doesn't really visit people. And once the accusation is abroad, then if you start saying, I need to spend time with my family, people will say it's just laziness. So you do need to start communicating it in a nice, winsome way, not right off the bat saying, I want you all to know that, in a winsome way, and spend a lot of time with the people who most likely wouldn't understand your need to be with your family. You got anything to add on that?
Only that the more naturally you approach that whenever a specific instance comes up. Can you speak to our women's meeting on Wednesday night? Wednesday night is the night that you and your wife were going to go out for dinner for the first time in 8 months, you know. A super apologetic kind of over-explaining, anxious kind of way is going to give away a tone that you don't want to give, a defensiveness. A real natural, no, I'm going out with my wife that night, I'm really looking forward to it, we just haven't had any time to ourselves, is going to communicate something positive to them. I mean, yes, you're turning down their meeting, but you're also affirming something that maybe that person needs to hear about their own marriage. And you make it a little model that when you are saving time for your family, you're using the fact that you are turning somebody away, even that can be a teaching model for the people that you're saying no to. And if all else fails, fib. Jay Adams used to say that he would block out, I think this is Jay Adams,
this is
somebody
fib.
We knew, not a fib, block out in his day timer, you know, to take his son to the fair, and when somebody called him, he would say, I have a commitment for them.
Sure.
That's not a fib. Yeah,
that's
a commitment. That's not a fib. Didn't say.
Other questions? By the way, the powers that be are going to bring down that curtain on this anytime. I don't know when it's.
We'll cut off at 9 if that's all right. Or is that too long?
No, well, that's as long as you're not bored.
The audience can vote.
We love to hear ourselves talk.
The audience can vote by just running out of questions.
I'd like to just underscore the fact that depending on the size of the church, the ministry thing really is differently because.
Oh, yeah.
Being part of a large staff, you can slip away on a weekend. You don't have preacher responsibility.
If a church is under 200 people, that you're expected usually to be a member of the extended family of every family.
Mm-hmm. And generally on a large staff, you should be there 9 to 5. You can't slip out in the afternoon. So it's just what's expected of you. It's a totally different.
Yeah, I've often felt that this is all full of self-justification. I've often felt that in a large church, you have less excuse to be overworking. But I'm just full of self-justification. I'm sorry.
Didn't you start, Ken? Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I did. Okay. How helpful is Kathy to you in terms of your preaching? Now I know that's
a great question.
You know, didn't we talk on that once at WOW? Didn't we have a how you can? A couple of years ago now, right?
Yeah, we'd like you to do
that,
it in the spring.
That one really, I remember that one really well. I can't remember why.
You have to let him listen to the tape. That's what he says.
I forget. What did we say then?
I'll start talking, and you think, this is how we usually work, is I shoot off my mouth, and then he has a chance to think of something.
And I look so wise. I can correct her and look so wise.
Early on in our ministry, I was a very big part of improving his preaching. At this point, he doesn't preach that often, that regularly, but also I don't have that much to say unless it was a minor adjustment, such as your delivery was too fast, you really need to slow down, and those will be the kinds of things he already knows. Yes, I was rushed for time and I tried to put too much in. But early on, the first thing that Tim would say when we got in the car to leave the church was, well, how was my sermon?
First thing.
Oh, boy.
And if I would launch in and say, well, it was so-and-so. That was not the best way to approach it. The best way to approach it was saying, well, what did you think? What kind of comments did you get? Yeah. And by that time, he would pretty much touch on all the things he was uneasy about. And then my role could be that of shoring up and agreeing rather than confronting.
Well, you said so.
How about the signal?
Well, the little signal. Well, real early on, whenever you don't have any sense of what you look like, I mean, I don't do enough public speaking that I'm still at this stage. If I ever have to deliver a talk, I don't have any sensation of what I'm like externally, okay? If you do enough public speaking, you get a pretty good assessment of that, but Tim didn't, and he would go too fast, or he'd get too agitated or something, and so we had little signals so that this one meant calm down.
Right.
Yeah, my hair used to be a
lot
longer.
Hair, so it was easier to see her out there. Now you can't see. If you go like this, I meant slow down.
This one was cut. That's You've right. already ended your sermon on a high point. Don't add three more
That's
points.
Right. Major problem. I used to not
this
know
one was,
when to end.
I can't hear you. Be louder.
That's right. It worked out very well.
Then he quit looking at me, though. He got real self-confident.
Sometimes I decided, no, it's not time to stop yet.
Well, then there were other times, for instance, like when he forgot to baptize the child that was sitting there crying all the way through the sermon. And I had to run downstairs and get some water in a styrofoam cup and write a little sign and hold it here.
Don't forget to baptize the baby.
All of the grandparents were in the pew.
Yeah, what was really great about that was afterwards, everybody said, I thought it was the neatest thing to do the baptism after the sermon. And I took all my credit for it. Remember that?
Yeah.
It was great. And I said, yeah, I'll have to do that more often.
Darlene and Carrie's second baby.
Yeah. Yes, Charles.
Question number 11. Your lifestyle, your way of presenting your home in comparison to the congregation you might be coming to.
Yeah, comment on number 10 while you're answering.
Personal liberty.
Those two go together. They're related,
yeah.
Yeah, they go together. Well, I'll shoot off my mouth while he thinks.
You have to contextualize.
That's right. You have to contextualize. That's what I was going to say. You have to find a way to make the things that wherein you differ something that they consider an asset or at least neutral. In other words, you're going to be different than your congregation. Even if you grew up in that congregation, went off to seminary and came back, you're going to be a changed person. And for the sake of the ministry, for the sake of reaching those people, you're going to contextualize. You're going to learn to speak their language, whether it's a Southern drawl or whether it's a West Coast ambiance or whatever it is. You will learn to incarnate yourself in their culture for the sake of reaching them. At the same time, you do have to have a sense of your own personal liberty and your own ministry, and they need to look at that as an asset, to wit. We used to have teenagers come over, walk through the door, walk into the dining room, and just stare at Tim. This happened
Wore
a
jeans.
Couple times. And they'd bring their buddies. They'd say, "See, I told you my pastor wore blue jeans." Nah, I couldn't have believed it unless I seen it. And, you know, that was something that they had never seen before. Here we were sort of exegesis people and in a small southern town, and it was an asset with a certain group of people, which you don't flaunt in front of the people that it would be,
right.
You know, a stumbling block for. Same for the rock music and the chasing each other naked through the house. I mean, there's some things that you don't.
Right. We at least didn't talk about.
Yeah, right.
The lifestyle, one of the advantages of having a manse, which we lived in a manse, we did not own our own home, was we lived where they bought it, you know, the size and everything. And to a certain degree, your lifestyle, when you have a manse, is determined very much by the congregation. In the long run, having a manse is a real disaster economically. But I must say that outside of that, being a disaster for you personally, there's all kinds of advantages to having a manse. In other words, it's not a disaster until 20, 30 years, but you know, in the present, there's great advantages. One of them is that they really are saying, here's where we want our minister to live, and usually live in the neighborhood and at the level where the rest of the congregation is, generally. Or maybe a little bit up. Generally speaking, congregations don't give you a manse. They don't give you a lifestyle right below where most of the folks in the congregation are. They give it a little bit higher, I guess. But that's one of the great advantages of having a manse. And we lived in a manse, and in a certain sense, didn't have to worry about that. But by and large, you do have to be very, very careful that you can go to China as a missionary and create a little compound. Your house can become a compound, so that you actually you flaunt the difference. You flaunt the differences. You make a little fortress, and inside you're still American, and you just sort of keep everything out. And that can even happen in the ministry. But basically, I think you have to aim at generally your lifestyle has to aim somewhere in the middle of your congregation, somewhere where most of your folks are. Personal liberty, Craig. I'm not sure what you're after. Want to ask me a little more specifically?
All kinds of things, you know, apply to that. You've touched on it, like the blue jeans, rock and roll music.
I never, ever, ever went into, the best pizza place in town was the Anchor Room.
Oh, yeah.
It was a bar, best pizza in the world, and there's absolutely no reason why I couldn't have gone there to eat pizza. In 10 years, I never went in there, never. Because simply, you couldn't communicate properly to
even
people.
Even the non-Christians in town would lose respect.
Oh,
for
yeah, this
the
is it's ridiculous. So what
right.
I would, yeah, what I would do is I would tell everybody how silly it is to have those kinds of standards. But then what I would, you realize, who would I tell this to? People that I could preach to, people I could talk to. But that's only a small percentage of the culture. Mm-hmm. And unless you're able to explain an action that communicates indeed something totally different than what you really mean by it, then it's no reason to thumb your nose at the culture and say, well, I know that what I'm doing is all right, and if you're misreading it, then tough. But the fact that's what communication is all about. You have to make sure that people understand what you're saying. So there was all sorts of ways in which I limited my behavior and so on. Didn't bother me. I never felt like a hypocrite at all.
How do you know it was great pizza if you never went in?
Because people would bring it to me.
And I'll vouch for it, too.
And that's right. Good pizza. Very good pizza. Always was.